Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Joel, it's Listener Question Monday, and we've got five great questions from some listeners. We're going to answer one about a Roth 401k versus a traditional 401k. We've got another question about how paying off some credit card debt, how that actually lowered somebody's score. And then we're also going to discuss just talking to your parents about their money.
That's always fun.
Yeah, it's a little awkward at times, but it's always fun.
Exactly. Well, you know what? And Monday is typically not fun. I don't know if they're more or less fun because of the pandemic. Like, does it feel just like every other day? Or, I don't know, maybe Mondays aren't as bad as they used to be.
Well, you know how I've previously told you how Kate and I, we watch a movie on Friday, kind of make it a little more fun, make sure that we can tell the difference between the weekdays and the weekends with the kids home all summer long and with the inability to get out and do stuff. We watch a movie. Well, on Mondays, we tend to clean the house. And so we try to make Mondays worse because nobody wants to clean their house, but it's something that we have to do. We need to make sure that we're not living like animals, but we purposefully do that on Mondays. And I just kind of chose that day randomly like several months ago. But every Monday, we do a little bit of cleaning around the house.
Get back into the swing of things.
It helps, you know, yeah. like we're doing stuff on the weekend. A lot of times we're going hiking. And so we come home from those hikes or from bike rides. We're just covered in dirt. The girls are tracking in all sorts of debris. And we just let it ride all weekend long. But then Monday, it's kind of like, all right, let's get back to business. Let's clean the house. And at the same time, make Mondays a drag. So
just generally hate our lives on Mondays. Let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, first, man, before we actually tackle these listener questions, I got a frugal or cheap for you.
Oh, bring it.
What are your thoughts on selling a gift on eBay? I'll tell you, Kate, she received a very fancy high-end gift that she does not have a use for, that she does not use, and that would be better served as cash in her accounts. You know, we have our own accounts. And so we took that item, and I'm not going to say what it is because the person that gave her that gift, I'm pretty sure they listened to the show. And so I don't think they would be upset, but at the same time, we're going to play it safe. But we went ahead and we listed it on eBay. I just looked it up. It is currently at $456.
Oh my gosh, so it's a really nice gift.
It's a very nice gift, like I said, man. And we've got three more days to go. So, I mean, we're kind of expecting that to maybe even hit 800. She's pretty excited.
Dang.
But obviously, we think that this is a total frugal move and we don't have too many issues, I'll say, about selling it. But what are your thoughts, man?
Oh, man. That's a tough one. It's always hard to know whether you can or should resell a gift that you've been given. I think so much of it depends on who gives it to you and what it is, like how much thought was put behind it, whether you're kind of expected to use or wear that thing in
exactly,
public,
yeah,
right?
That's a big consideration, sure.
Yeah, are they going to expect you to wear it at the next holiday function, whatever it might be? I would say if it's not one of those things where it's highly visible and if it's worth that much money, I would be totally in the camp of selling, and I think it's a frugal move.
Frugal move?
Yeah.
All right. I'll make sure that she knows that she has your blessing.
I'd love to hear from our listeners on that too, because I'm sure they've run into a similar conundrum.
Yeah, you're always torn because you think, well, like this was given to me, but then at the same time, what would they rather appreciate? You just keeping that thing in your closet or your attic until you give it away,
right?
You know, until you donate it or throw it out on the curb or maybe sell it for like pennies on the dollar at a yard sale. Or go ahead and just unload it, get some money, and then Kate will be able to use that money and, you know, purchase lots of other things that
right.
she would much rather have. And to answer you, this isn't an item that was given with a whole lot of meaning and sentiment behind it. You know, it was, I honestly think it was kind of a sort of like a re-gift, which is, I think that person felt bad about not using that gift as well. And so kind of pass the buck along to Kate.
Oh, there we go.
And
well, if that happened, then it's definitely frugal. Like, you
yeah,
can totally sell
it. You think
it.
So? Okay.
All right, so it totally reminds me, too, one Christmas, I think I was like 21, and my grandpa got me Hardy Boys books, which
okay.
I'm pretty sure those are intended for 12-year-olds or maybe even younger. And I remember reading Hardy Boys when I was a kid, and I was like, yeah, pretty sure I'm not the right demo for this. obviously, he didn't say that to my grandpa's face, but I think I just gave him away. But if it had
yeah.
been worth more, I would have been totally comfortable selling those because obviously, it just wasn't a gift I was going to be able to use.
Yeah, I remember Hardy Boys, man, with the blue covers.
Oh, yeah. It was a great series back in the day.
Yeah, I read a few of them, but I didn't get super into them. But yeah, if you would have been able to make maybe $800 from them, maybe you would have unloaded them.
It would have been gone immediately.
Yeah, man.
All right, Matt, let's mention the beer that we're having on the show today. This is called Dr. Funke's Sour Ale, and it's by Wrecking Bar Brewpub. And by the way, Dr. Funke, everybody knows that's a Arrested Development reference, right?
Even I, who don't watch... Well, I do watch Arrested Development. I watch season one, but even I, who am not the biggest fan, yeah, I know the reference here.
The fact that you stopped there massively disappoints me.
On the can, I'll say it says Dr. T.O. Funke, Theralist. So for all the Arrested Development fans out there, I'm guessing you'll appreciate that.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, I'm looking forward to drinking this sour pale ale with you today, man.
And I will say to the can art, it's very blue. On the outside.
Yeah, from the Blue Man Group days. And yeah, exactly. All right, let's get on to the questions at hand, Matt. We are taking listener questions on today's episode. For anybody out there who wants Matt and I to tackle your question on an upcoming Ask HTM episode, just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions for how you can submit your voice question so that we can take that question on an upcoming episode. All right, Matt, let's get to the first one. This one's about, what do you do when you've made money selling a home?
This is Kevin from Maryland. Love the show. I wanted to ask a question for both of you. We are currently in a 3-bedroom home that I bought in 2012, shortly out of college. Since then, I've met my wife, had 2 kids, and now have 2 work-from-home jobs. As a result, we are looking to move in spring 2021 to a larger home to meet our needs, and I'm interested to see how you would allocate and use the funds from the sale. Our current mortgage is around $130,000, home value is around $310,000, and the estimated proceeds from a sale would be around $170,000 after paying the realtor. Our next home price is probably going to be in the $450,000 range. We have 10% saved as a down payment separate from proceeds from the sale of our first home. Clearly, I would need to use part of the proceeds from the home sale to at least get to 20% to avoid the PMI payment. This will leave me around $125,000 in proceeds I need to decide what to do with. Do I immediately roll this over into equity on the new house, or do I dollar cost average into the market a substantial portion of it? I hate to sink it into my mortgage at around 3% interest and not have the cash easily available if needed. My current strategy is to pay extra into my mortgage each month, but I'm keeping it in a separate taxable brokerage to hopefully get the rate of return from the market, and when that amount reaches my outstanding mortgage balance, we'll pay it off. This is the account that we'll be funding the 10% down out of for our second home. Any help is appreciated. I've never sold a house before and hope we don't have to for a long time. Love the show. Thanks.
Kevin, thanks so much for that question, man. You've got 2 work-from-home jobs. You've also got 2 kids. I'm glad to hear that you don't have 2 wives. But it sounds like you are working hard. And I love that you included the realtor, the transaction fees involved in selling your house, because that's something you definitely want to take into account with your calculations. And also congrats on coming out that far ahead in 8 years of home ownership. You're obviously buttoned up, you know, in regards to your finances in general. So kudos there. And Joel, man, I don't envy folks who are first-time home buyers right now. You know, like the housing market, it's super hot. It's making it difficult for first-time home buyers to find something because the supply, it's so limited right now, driving up prices. But at least if you're selling a home in addition to buying one, maybe it kind of balances out. You know, like you might be spending maybe a little bit more for that new house, but you're probably also able to sell your older home for a pretty penny as well.
Yeah, that's for sure. Across, you know, almost all the country, prices have shot through the roof, especially as interest rates have declined.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Kevin, I think getting to 20%, like you mentioned, yeah, that is really, really important, right? That ensures that you don't pay PMI, saving you potentially $150 or more a month. PMI is not the worst thing in the world, but Matt, you and I, we really believe that people should typically save up for a longer period of time in order to be able to put a full 20% down on a home. Buying a home when you've only got 3 or 5% to put down just puts you in an uncomfortable position, not to mention the increased costs that come along with that, right? And there are some exceptions like VA loans and people that are house hacking. I think if you're investing inside of that purchase, then you can change the dynamics a little bit and you can rethink how much you're putting down. But for the most part, yeah, getting to 20% makes sense for most people.
Yeah, and something else to consider as well is that with bankers tightening lending requirements, there actually could be a chance, Kevin, that you'll need to come to the table with more money than you think at least currently, right? There have been some reports of individuals needing to put more money down than they were initially quoted in order for them to get the rate that they want. And you mentioned that you work from home, but you didn't specify whether or not you're self-employed. But if you are self-employed, the documentation that's required if you own your own business, it's become even more burdensome in order to get a loan. And the same thing goes as well if you are looking to refinance as well. It's just gotten a lot harder if you work for yourself.
Yeah, banks aren't as loose when it comes to lending as they were even just a year ago, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Things have tightened up a good bit. The prepayment also from the brokerage account proceeds, that's not a bad idea. Although it feels tough to pull money out of an account that's lost money, and that's a distinct possibility if you were to go in that direction. I think I, Matt, would rather see Kevin take advantage of an insanely low mortgage rate while putting that 20% down. He'll be in a great spot, right? And then take the rest of the money and put it in tax-advantaged retirement accounts that you can then continue to invest in through the years. Or you've got two jobs, so depending on what they are and whether one is self-employed or not, you might be able to qualify for multiple accounts.
Yeah, there are all sorts of accounts out there. For example, SEP IRAs, they allow you to sock away a ton of money every single year. This year, the contribution limit is $57,000. So that is a lot of money. That's a lot of proceeds from that sale that you can put towards your retirement.
Yeah, it depends on what your income is from that job and whether it is, you know, a self-employment income or not. But my preference is to see you do that instead, right? And then ultimately, Kevin, you mentioned prepaying on a mortgage, and especially with rates being essentially below 3% on 30-year money right now, I don't think it should be a major financial goal for you. Unless you're just incredibly debt averse, right? And this is kind of where personal finances get personal. I personally would rather take advantages of tax breaks and invest more for the long term while letting that loan ride out over the full term. But there are lots of different perspectives on this. And I think Matt and I actually kind of differ on this a little bit too. Matt, you've kind of changed your mindset when it comes to paying down long-term low interest rate debt versus investing, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know if I've completely jumped to the other side of the fence, right? Maybe I'm straddling it a little bit, but I've personally been attracted to the idea of paying off lower interest debt for the sake of the emotional and the psychological effects. Kate and I, we're getting close to actually completely paying off our HELOC that we used to renovate our home with. You know, it's only at 3.25%. That's not very high. And, you know, sure, I could invest it and probably get more if that money was sitting there in the market. But that money isn't guaranteed, you know, and 3.25%, like, that is guaranteed. And of course, not to mention just the emotional and the psychological benefits of being completely done with that debt. So I'll keep you posted as I kind of go down this path a little bit. But this is an instance where I'm looking at, yeah, potentially ignoring the numbers, or not ignoring, but at least not basing my decision completely on the numbers. But I'm also looking at some of the other components and the effects that, you know, paying off a mortgage would have.
Yeah, I feel like Kevin's in this like choose your own adventure book scenario, right?
Speaking of Hardy Boys,
where he can kind of go in whatever direction he chooses, and none of the paths are bad, right? They're just different. And so, yeah, I think the fact that he set himself up to be able to make a decision like this is great. And that actually says a lot more about him and his future ability to make smart financial moves than what he specifically does with the proceeds of his home. As long as, I think, he puts that 20% number down, right? That's huge. When you've got it, you don't want to avoid that. But besides that, whether he chooses to invest or whether he chooses to put even more money down, let's say 30, 35% down on the home initially, or even just to add additional monthly payments. You know, whatever direction you go in, Kevin, it's going to be okay. And so much of it comes down to personal preference.
That's right, man. So we've got more questions ahead pertaining to credit scores as well as retirement account options. And we'll get to all of those right after this break. All right, Joel, we're back from the break. And now let's take a question about a health savings account.
Hi guys, I'm Corey from Charlotte, North Carolina, longtime listener, first time question. I wanted to ask you about HSAs. I know that you've mentioned a few times how good HSAs are as a shelter for non-taxable funds. I'm curious, at this point of the year, if I wanted to go ahead and max out the rest of my contribution for the year, which is about $3,500, should I go ahead and do that from my already taxed funds and then just take the refund at the end of the year so that I don't incur any overage? Or should I just let it keep accumulating from my paycheck each month the same way that it always has until it gets to the max? Thanks in advance. Bye.
Corey, thanks for listening for such a long time, man. Much appreciated. And I love your willingness to max out your HSA. Dude, that is an awesome account, a triple tax advantage. And actually, as we're about to get into here, it has like another additional, almost like fourth benefit. So the HSA is a stellar account. Matt, we did an episode all about the HSA. That was a while back, though.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean we love it any less. Right. Especially, too, as we're about to talk about how it's not only triple tax advantage, but it's like triple plus. There's this extra little advantage as well.
Yeah, and I think the fact that Corey wants to max it out when we're basically just over halfway through the year, it's even more telling about how on the ball he is with his finances.
Yeah, man, we've got some savvy listeners for sure.
But I think what Corey needs to take into consideration is that maybe it's not best to max out your HSA too early in the year. And that's because of what you said, that triple plus tax advantage. It's that feature of having an HSA through your employer, right? You will want to max out the HSA over the course of the full year, but doing it too quickly could actually cost you some money in taxes. And that's because HSA contributions can be payroll tax deductible. So you eliminate additional FICA, Medicare, and Social Security taxes on top of the income tax deduction that you're getting from investing in an HSA. So if you make the full contribution in, let's say, 8 months instead of 12, you'll potentially be missing out on those additional tax savings from avoiding those payroll taxes that you're able to skip out on by taking the whole year to essentially max out that HSA.
Yeah, by keeping those HSA contributions deducted from your paycheck, you get to maximize those payroll tax deductions. And Corey, also, you know, by keeping it on this sort of regular schedule of it, you know, being deducted from your paycheck, you have the added benefit of automatically dollar cost averaging over the course of the year. You know, since you already have this system in place, right, since your employer is already deducting it from your check, it'd make a lot of sense to just stick with that. You know, you might be tempted to want to get that money in the market now, get it invested ASAP, right, in an attempt maybe to time the market. Maybe you foresee the market continuing to climb real steeply, or you want to be able to take advantage of any dips. But the problem is we have no idea what the market's going to do. So in this case, Joel and I would suggest that, you know, you kind of go with the bird in hand, take full advantage of that payroll tax benefit.
Yeah, don't overthink it. I mean, I love your eagerness, right, to invest and do it even more quickly.
And optimize. Yeah, he's thinking through all these things. It's great.
Right. But in this case, overthinking it could actually cost you money in additional taxes. And we'd like for you to avoid that and just keep spreading it out over 12 months, but max it out like you can under that allotted period. So, Corey, best of luck. Keep it up. All right, Matt, let's get to the next question. This one's about Roth or regular 401ks. Which one's better?
Hey, Matt and Joel. My name's Dawn, and I'm from Illinois. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, and I have a two-part question for you. So the 401k plan my employer offers allows me to contribute to either a traditional 401k or a Roth 401k. I'm currently putting 17% of my salary into my 401k, and I'm putting 60% into the Roth and 40% into the traditional. Considering I'm in my early 20s, and I feel like my salary is unlikely to ever reach a higher tax bracket, do you think this is a good balance, or would you do a different balance? Secondly, my employer does a 100% contribution match for up to 5% of my salary, but my employer's contribution is only fully vested once I've worked for the company for 5 years. At 4 years, it would be 75% vested. I'm pretty sure this means they'll be taking back a percentage of their contribution if I leave before 5 years. I'm curious how common this is for companies to do and how obligated people should feel to hit that 5-year mark to be fully vested. I'm considering moving out of state in the next couple of years, which would put me right around that 4 or 5 year mark, which is why I'm asking. Can't wait to hear your opinion. Thanks.
Don, thanks so much for being a fan. And let's go ahead and address the fact that you are saving 17% of your income towards retirement. That
Baller.
Is amazing. You were crushing it. Seriously impressive. And also, you mentioned that you don't think you're necessarily going to earn more down the road. I would say to don't underestimate yourself. If you're the kind of person that is already setting aside 17% of their income towards retirement, I think there's a good chance you might actually earn more down the road, and you would be in a higher tax bracket. Although maybe you're saving that much now because you know you're planning to retire early. Who knows?
Or take a job that pays less. Like, who knows what her path
there's
is?
A lot of considerations.
But there's
for sure.
Always a decent chance that somebody like Don, who is thoughtful about investing such a large percentage of their income, that they are going to do better in the future.
Dude, seriously, people want to hire somebody who's smart. Don, I love that you're mixing it up, though. You know, you mentioned how you've got 60% of your retirement going towards a Roth and 40% towards a traditional 401k. It's always hard to predict, you know, what your tax bracket will be further on down the road, you know, or even what the tax situation will look like in our country. I tend to think that taxes, like, they are bound to go up over the years, and I prefer to invest in Roth vehicles myself. But
I just use my Magic 8-Ball, and it tells me what's going to happen, which is great. Super helpful.
Yet to be determined. Actually, I don't even know what Magic 8-Ball says. I never actually owned one of those, did you?
No, but my cousins did. I like to play with it.
I feel like that was the toy that you always had a friend that had one of those.
Oh, yeah.
But I never owned that myself.
But they were cool for a couple years.
Oh, for sure, man. But Don, you know, another factor, too, that you want to consider, something else that'll weigh in your decision-making, are some things like state taxes. You live in Illinois, which has a 5% state income tax. If you're moving to Florida or maybe a state like Tennessee in the future, you're going to have a 0% income tax. And so investing in a traditional 401k now would make more sense if you know you're going to maybe move back home to be closer to family in the future and they happen to live in Tennessee. But let's say, for instance, you're moving to California because that's where your family lives. Well, then a Roth would make more sense because the income taxes there are a lot higher.
It's amazing how nuanced it gets, Matt, and how something like state income taxes can play a role in your decision here. One cool thing about favoring a traditional 401k is kind of the optionality that you gain by going the traditional route, right? First, you save on taxes now, which is great, means more money in your pocket while you're investing for the future. And then you can convert that traditional 401k to a Roth IRA at some point in the future when your income is lower. So let's say Dawn knows that her income's going to be lower, right? She's like, I'm going to go work for a nonprofit after these few years at this company where I will earn a substantial amount less. Well, then contributing to that traditional 401k now and then converting to a Roth IRA down the road can actually be a bigger tax savings overall, right? And a lot of people do this, especially if they're going to take a year off. If they're going to take a sabbatical year and do some traveling or whatever, and you know for sure that your income is going to be lower, then you can plan ahead and strategize when it comes to taxes like that. And this also means that there might be a little bit of added complexity in your life, but it might be worth doing if you're like a total optimizer.
Yeah, plus a 17% saver, they can handle that. Joel, on the flip side, you know, one of the great benefits of a Roth 401k is that you're able to essentially force yourself to be disciplined, and you do the unappealing work of paying taxes on your contributions now. You know, you front load that pain a little bit, you pay those taxes, and then you'll never have to worry about it again. You know, it could even kind of feel like you're able to save and invest more over time due to the fact that you're not stuck paying a massive tax bill once you're 59 and a half.
Yeah, once that money's in there with a Roth, it's never taxed again. And that's nice to see that and know that it's the actual number that you're going to have to spend once you hit retirement age, for sure.
Exactly.
And then let's talk about vesting period. Don asked about that as well. That's an awesome employer match you've got, which is great. You should be thankful for that, right? Any sort of decent employer match is always something to be happy with, and you got to do your best to make sure you take full advantage. But yes, they will take some or all of that money back if you don't stay employed with them for the full vesting period. We talked about vesting periods recently, actually, Matt, I think on another episode. I think it was another listener question.
Yeah.
But they're incredibly common, and some do stretch for as long as 5 years. Other employers have more like 3-year time periods. Some employers let their contributions vest immediately, which is always nice, but it's kind of a way to retain talent. And so it is important to take into consideration because, yeah, you could be costing yourself thousands of dollars if you don't meet those requirements of how long you're employed there in order to keep that money in your account and not have it clawed back.
And just a side note, I just like the term vested. There's something about that phrase, like, I'm fully vested. Makes you sound pretty hardcore, doesn't it?
Makes me want to wear a 3-piece suit because they come with vests.
I'd say, Don, for you, basically what we need to do here is to do the math. You know, you're asking if it makes sense for you to maybe stick around for that full 5 years. We don't know how much you make, but let's say you make $80,000 a year. That means your employer is contributing $4,000 annually. And so that's $20,000 over a 5-year period. And so you would receive $12,000 in an employer match after hitting that 4-year mark if you're going to get 75%. So what you need to do next is essentially just run a cost-benefit analysis. You know, is it worth an additional $8,000 to stay an extra year there with that company? You know, maybe your next job pays that much more just right off the bat. If that's the case, then you can just move on for sure if you want to move. Or, you know, maybe in your case, maybe it's not about the money. Like, would you give up $8,000 just to be able to move on and get on with the next phase of your life? It all depends where you're at, years down the road, and what you want to be doing next. We can answer that question for you, but hopefully that gives you a decent framework to kind of think about this question. I know that I wouldn't necessarily put my life on hold, you know, for a whole year or two in order to meet that vesting period, but I would certainly be willing to maybe wait an extra month or two, maybe even 6, to hit a payout benchmark. Don, that's a great question, and hopefully you'll be able to, you know, make the best decision for you. And in the meantime, just keep saving like a crazy person. You're doing a great job.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, Matt, I agree. If I was like 3 years and 10 months, I'll wait that extra two months in order to hit that 75%.
Oh, yeah.
It's zero versus 75. Like, yeah, I'll totally wait. But then I might get the heck out of there. Another year in order to get the extra 8K. It just depends on where you want to go with
your life.
Depends
on what you got going on, man.
Yeah. But all right, Don, best of luck to you. All right, Matt, we got a couple more questions to get to, including how in the world does a credit score go down when you've paid off credit card debt? And we'll get to that right after this break.
All right, Joel, we're back from the break now. We're taking listener questions. And let's hear now from a listener who has knocked out some consumer debt.
Hello, this is Mindy from Denver. I recently removed all of my consumer credit card debt. And within 30 days, I tracked my credit score that dropped from 775 to 725. So I guess I'd like some insights as to how it is that we prevent our credit score from such dramatic dips when we're doing what we think is the right thing, which is reducing debt. Thank you.
Mindy, thanks for your question. And yeah, this is an interesting one because a 50-point drop in your credit score is not a lot of fun to see.
Yeah.
And it can be disconcerting depending on kind of where you're at. If you are about to buy a house or take out a car loan, I mean, that can drastically affect the rate you're going to get. So I would be a little upset as well, especially when you've done something good, like paying off credit card debt. It's like, how does that happen?
That would be the frustrating part for me. It's like, this does not compute.
Exactly. And credit scores sometimes don't compute, right? I would say that they're kind of like a riddle wrapped up in an enigma. And you and I, Matt, we've tried to do our best to kind of explain how credit scores work. And ultimately, when you get down to it, a lot of it does make sense, but it's not necessarily intuitive, right?
Yeah, there are hundreds of factors that weigh into like the makeup of a credit score. Like, we know the main things that move the needle, but they take lots of things into account.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so it's a shame that the credit scoring model is so complex and that people have to put so much thought into it in order to, you know, raise their credit score and figure out how to work the system. But it is a part of our modern financial system, and we got to play the game to kind of avoid the adverse consequences of not having a good score. Right?
Yeah, that's right, man. And Mindy, too, I want to give you a little bit more credit because I know in your question you said that you removed your consumer debt or your credit card debt. You make it sound like you kind of like deleted an app from your phone. And like, getting rid of debt is a huge thing, especially if you have a lot of it. So instead, let's use like the language of like you annihilating your credit card debt. You didn't just remove it. You attacked it and you got rid of it.
Took an axe to it like a big tree.
It's no longer in your life. You felled it. Felled like a tree, not
right.
Failed.
Yes. Okay.
But Mindy, to answer your question, why did your credit score drop? And one possibility is that you closed that account after payoff. You know, if you close an account, which by the way, this happens automatically when, you know, let's say you pay off a car loan or a student loan, those installment loans close. And if that were to be the case, then your score will go down if the account closes. Again, this is kind of counterintuitive because, you know, when you pay off debt, that should have the opposite effect. And that can be really frustrating for consumers to see their credit score drop after they've completely eliminated not just the debt, but also when that account gets removed from their file as well.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to make sense. And I think that's why a lot of people do close a credit card once they paid it off. They're like, look, see, I'm closing it off. No more temptation. I'm not going to do that again. And that can be good from like a personal temptation standpoint.
If
right?
That's what you need, then do it by all means. But I think this is something that like the Dave Ramsey adherents, they're like, why is my credit score going down? This is not something that Dave talks about your credit score dropping, because he's all about removing credit from your life. But we know that your credit score is important in lots of areas of your life.
Right. But let's say too, maybe Mindy didn't close the credit card. You know,
maybe it's still open.
That is one explanation that she did. But let's say that you didn't close it and you paid it off. The only other thing that I've seen that can truly affect your credit score in a negative way after paying off debt like that is that going from a low utilization to something like no utilization can kind of have a weird effect on your score too. Some scoring models, depending on what one you're looking at, Matt, and that's another wrench in the game. There are just so many different scoring models that, well, which one are you looking at? It depends. And they all look at things differently and they take different factors into consideration. But some might view that as an inactive account. And if they do that, then your score is going to drop. But in the end, your credit should rebound quickly, right? This isn't a move that's going to hurt your score over the long haul. Mindy, this should be a dip for a few months. And I think that your score is going to bounce right back up to where it was pretty quickly. So it's an annoyance, right? It's tough to see. It's frustrating to endure something like that when you've made all the right moves. But it's kind of one of those weird things that happens in like the current flawed system.
Yeah, and Mindy, in the end, it's just better to be done paying interest to the credit card companies and to, you know, just have that short-term ding to your credit score. And by the way, you know, 725, you mentioned that that's your score. Like, that's a solid score. And my guess is that you'll be back above 740 quickly, and that'll put you back in top-tier status. So best of luck to you.
Yeah, don't spend much more time thinking about it. You're basically beating your head against a wall trying to figure out what happened in something that's almost inexplicable. All right, Matt, let's get to our next question. This one is from a listener who's trying to help his parents think about their retirement.
Hey, Matt and Joel. Josh from Chicago here. I need some advice from my parents. They're in their late 50s and are looking to retire within the next 8 to 10 years. Where should I point them to invest their money for these next few years to try and build up as much as possible? They probably don't have anything in 401ks or Roth IRAs, and so they're starting from scratch pretty late in the game. But any advice you have, how to talk to them, how to have that conversation, and then also where they can put their money specifically would be helpful. Thanks.
Hey, Josh, I love that you are trying to help your parents. You know, especially as our parents age, their financial decisions will likely have major ramifications on our own finances. And so this is, you know, this is great for them, but it's also, it's good for you to do too. And so starting the conversation with them now, it's really important, even when it's not something that they've discussed with you before. So, you know, let's go ahead and talk about that. It's important to broach the subject in a non-threatening way.
I prefer to put the finger in the face. Mom and Dad, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, rub their noses in it a little bit, you know?
I've got the combative style, though.
That is your style. Josh, we would recommend for you to check out episode 114. We went into great detail with Cameron Huddleston about this. She has some great thoughts on getting that conversation started and has even written a book about talking with your parents about their money. And so depending on your relationship, even a third party might be helpful to facilitate that discussion. You know, it might be weird for your parents to hear financial advice from you, you know, like you're their kid. And so that might be awkward for them, or they may not be comfortable hearing that from you. And so maybe having somebody else there to kind of help them walk through that might be helpful. Just depends on your situation.
Yeah, trusted third party to help break some of the ice and make the conversation a little smoother can be really helpful. I think part two, Matt, of that involves helping your parents see the need to save and invest more, right? And people are living longer. Social Security likely won't be able to cover all of their living expenses. And so even if they think they can continue working, well, the workforce isn't always kind to people, especially as they get older and get into their later 60s, right? So it's important for them to be prepared. And that has to start now. I mean, there's just no other time that it can start. And yeah, so I think a large part of that conversation is actually maybe helping them realize their need to be saving and investing, you know, starting now.
Yeah. And Josh, you know, some good news here. It's great that your parents, that they'll be working for close to another decade. You know, that means they won't be retiring until their late 60s. And this is great for two reasons, right? First, they have more time to invest in the market, which is crucial for them to not only earn money, but to grow that money. And then second, they'll be able to delay taking Social Security until closer to, or preferably at, age 70. The full retirement age is 66 or 67, depending on what year they were born in. But their ability to delay taking Social Security benefits until they're 70, that will mean that they will be able to receive a benefit that is 32% higher than the benefit that they would receive just a few years earlier. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, basically every year you wait after full retirement age, up to 4 years, you're going to see that increased benefit. And there's no other place that you can get a guaranteed return, especially at that age when you're investing. You're looking towards more conservative investments oftentimes. Well, delaying Social Security is the best sure thing for people as they get older. Taking Social Security early, especially before full retirement age, is going to have a massive impact on your overall earnings from Social Security. And Josh, you said they don't have anything in 401ks. But the question is, do they have access to one? And if so, in particular, if their company offers a match, then that's a no-brainer. That's really where they need to start. And I would explain that as well, that, you know, basically they're entitled to free money from their employer. If not, this is a case where probably a traditional IRA makes the most sense, assuming they're at or close to their peak earning years, and they're also likely in a higher tax bracket. Take the tax break now, and then when they retire and their income likely drops significantly, lowering their tax bracket, then they'll be paying less in taxes in those years. So yeah, when you're at your peak earning years, especially as you're closer to retirement, I think traditional IRAs do make more sense. And so yeah, if your parents don't have access to a 401k through work, then a traditional IRA is probably their best vehicle to start investing.
Yeah, and so hopefully your parents are pretty open to this discussion, Josh. And here's the thing, too, is that you can even help them to open one of these accounts, right? Sometimes it's just the step of going online. You know, that can be enough of a barrier, you know, where you have to go to the website to set up the account, transfer the money, choosing the funds. Like, all that can feel pretty overwhelming for maybe our parents' generation. So, you know, the ability to help them through the steps that they might otherwise avoid, I think that could also go a long way if you're able to kind of walk alongside them as they kind of set these up.
Yeah, I had to help my dad with that in regards to podcasts. He's like, where do you go? What do you do? How do you listen? And I'm like, oh, it's so much better, Dad, than regular radio that you're used to listening to. And there's such a larger variety of stuff you can tap into. So, yeah.
So what app did you download for him?
Well, so he has an iPhone, and he just already has the
already
Apple
has podcasts.
I didn't want to make it too complex.
Okay.
Like, here, learn this new app and new system. I just figured he was used to Apple stuff, so I did that. But
nice.
I've been listening on Google's podcast player, and it's excellent.
Oh,
man.
Yeah?
So good.
Nice. I actually recently switched over to Spotify like a few months ago. I've actually been a pretty big fan of that. Back in the day, you and I, we still always talk about CastBox. Do you remember them?
Still a solid app.
It still really is a really good one, but you and I both have kind of moved on a little bit. But Spotify, what I love about Spotify, and I feel like I've mentioned this before, but the handoff between the computer and the phone, it's almost seamless.
That's clutch.
It's so good. Like, you just open the program on your computer once you sit down at your desk and pull it up and just make the switch, and it'll almost pick it up to the word. Like, it'll repeat like two words, but like, it's right where you want it.
Nice.
Love it. It's so good. Yeah, so Josh, I hope that gets you pointed in the right direction, so that allows you to point your parents in the right direction as well.
Yeah, that helping hand from a kid as opposed to the finger in the face, it's it's so good. Don't be like me.
Yeah, I would have loved to have been there to see you yelling at your dad about, you know, not getting on podcast sooner.
That was a fun conversation. All right, Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had on the show. This one was called Dr. Fumke's Sour Pale Ale by Wrecking Bar Brew Pub right down the street from us. And yeah, what were your thoughts on this beer, man?
Yeah, this was a good one, man. It poured kind of a nice amber. You know, I think for a pale, maybe I was expecting something a little bit lighter, but this was a sour pale. So it had some of those tart notes, maybe even like a little bit of bitterness. It kind of had a similar bitterness that reminded me of tonic water. You know, you crack open a little bottle of that tonic water with some gin, and you kind of, there's some of that bitterness that you get from that tonic water. I feel like that this was that kind of bitterness. It didn't bash you over the head, but it was kind of just subtle from those hops. That plus the addition of the sour elements made this a really nice beer, man. I really enjoyed it. How about you?
Yeah, subtle, like a conversation with your parents about money, right?
And like it should be.
No, I really dug this one, man. I love the combo of sour and hoppy. I think those two elements go well together, yet almost nobody brews beers that are both sour and hoppy.
Yeah, there aren't a ton of them. And we recently talked about how we need to drink more beers that are this style, and I'm glad to see that we're following through and actually doing it.
Yeah, so this one's definitely worth getting. And I'm going to buy pretty much almost any beer that's got an Arrested Development theme going on.
The way to your heart is, it's pretty easy.
Yeah, I think Tobias Fünke, one of the best characters in television history, and I'm definitely going to look for more sour hoppy beers on the shelves.
I wanted to comment on the label as well. I can't not mention the fact that the label, it's got like his eyes, or a set of eyes, you know, kind of floating there with his background of blue. And it automatically conjures up visions of the Great Gatsby cover. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah.
it's a running theme in the book, you know, like when they're driving down the road and like the eyes are always there kind of watching. And I feel like they kind of designed and styled the label that way a little bit. You know, it's kind of gilded. There's gold and there's like a city there in the background and the eyes are kind of floating up there in space. It's interesting that they kind of combine this Arrested Development with what I would say is like kind of a Great Gatsby theme. But either way, I dig it. It's a good beer and kind of a fun label.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man, that's going to do it for this episode. For anybody who wants to submit a question to be featured on a future Ask HTM episode, well, we would love to hear it from you. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask. Again, simple directions there for you to submit your voice question to be on a future episode.
Yeah, and if you haven't already left us a review on the aforementioned Apple podcast, like Joel was talking about, we would be incredibly thankful if you did have an Apple device, if you went over there and did that. And you know what? If you don't have an Apple device, if you're like Joel and you're rocking that Droid, you can leave a review wherever it is that you listen to your podcast.
Or you can go into your parents' iPhone and leave a review there.
Oh, I bet. Did you actually match the 5 stars
Duh.
on your NAS phone as you subscribed them to us?
I'll take whatever I can get, man. No shame in that game.
I love it. That's perfect. This is the best podcast ever.
I didn't write one. I just clicked the 5 stars. I'm not going to do that. Be like, I love Joel. He's my favorite host of the How to Money.
Forget Matt. He sucks.
All right, buddy. Well, that's it, man. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.